Brad, name that tune.
Need to hear a little more.
I'll give you a hint. Beethoven was a composer.
Beethoven was what?
The composer. It's a joke. But you laughed.
This is a theme from a movie.
I can't hear it. I don't know what the heck's going on.
I.
We have hardly any audio here. Jack Nicholson. Jack Nicholson.
The Shining?
Yeah.
I guess I don't recognize it.
You wouldn't have won the contest.
No, I wouldn't have won that one. I don't recall that it's from The Shining. Because that was not, in my opinion, a very good movie.
You know what? I agree. I'm one of the few people who agree. You know, very few people say that. I thought it was incredibly overrated.
Oh, I did too. I think that's probably one of only two or three books of Stephen King's that I've read, and I liked it. I really liked the book, and I thought the movie just was a huge disappointment to me. I mean, it just relied on, you know, here's Jack,
right.
And you know,
it didn't scare me.
No. Didn't scare me, except as an author, I could sympathize with sitting there writing all work, no play makes Brad a dull boy. That part sang to me, but other than that, I mean...
When you take the production values, the location, the sets, if you just had a different story, it would have been great. I just didn't resonate with me as a really scary flick.
No, it didn't... Didn't work for me, but as I said, I really enjoyed the novel.
Well, okay. I mean, you know, Jack ate considerable portions of the scenery, but
he certainly did.
He still couldn't save it. He valued struggledly.
Yeah.
What was it? He struggled valiantly, or he valiant struggledly to get that reversal.
I think was clever, and I think that sets it up. Couldn't have said it better.
Okay, thank you. Let's get back to serious business here now.
Yes.
We're talking about top 10 real life. Now, we can't prove these are real life, but
these
are not off the great silver screen.
Right. That's the distinction, and thank you, Jeff. I should have said that at the beginning. These are ones that people report seeing. They claim they're real. But, you know, some, like I asked Paul the first two, which one, Mothman or Bigfoot? Well, Bigfoot, there's a lot of evidence. I should also say that these marvelous pieces of art, these monstrous pieces of art, were done by my good friend Dan Wolfman Allen, who whipped them off in about 2.5 nights for me.
Wow, great. Again, where did the top 10 list come from, Brent, for our listeners?
The top 10 list came from a survey I sent out to about 200 cryptozoologists. Zoologists.
What were they again?
Pardon me?
What were they called?
Cryptozoologists.
Oh, are they?
Such as Mr. Bartholomew.
Right.
And Mr. Lauren Coleman and people of that nature. And then ufologists and paranormalists and psychical researchers, etc., etc., etc. And had enough returns to, I think, make a very accurate listing. Now, I was quite surprised with number two, how often the Jersey Devil came up as people's favorite. So what can you tell us about the Jersey Devil, Paul?
Well, the Jersey Devil was a creature from the Pine Barrens that was reported around the turn of the century, 1900s, 1909 or so. And there are continual reports of this, kind of pterodactylish, I guess. Type creature, but definitely of a paranormal ilk, I'd say. One of the classic books here was by James McCloy and Ray Miller, and that was sort of the landmark book on the topic.
This has always struck me here again. This, as you said, rightly so, because you are an expert in this field, that the sightings didn't really begin until the early 1900s. But this goes way back to colonial period. This goes back to the 1700s. And it was the result of kind of a curse where a man having, you know, there's so many different stories, but a man cursing his about-to-be newborn child, and then because of the curse, the thing comes out. It's got a head like a collie dog, a face like a horse, a long neck. It has wings 2 feet long, back legs like those of a crane, but with horse's hoofs, and it walks on its back legs and these two short paws out in front. In other words, truly a monstrous type of creature. You know, again, in the delivery room, there had to be panic. And I think at the time, then, as I recall, one of the legends, the creature just went out in a puff of smoke up the fireplace chimney and then was seen in the woods, as you say, the Pine Barrens of New Jersey. But the legend of the Jersey Devil is very consistent and persistent. I remember back in the 60s when I was staying, visiting, spending a weekend with Ivan T. Sanderson, the noted zoologist. He received I don't know how many calls one night. And he'd always laugh and say, well, blooming old Jersey Devil's out roaming again. And just call after call came from people that one particular night who claimed to see the Jersey Devil.
Wow. He said,
it became an iconic figure.
Right.
They have a hockey team named after him.
Right.
It's part of the culture now.
It is. It's part of the culture. Now, the next one, kind of a favorite of mine, because again, I believe isn't the right word, because believe is for matters of faith, but I accept the concept of lake monsters of the Nessie sort. What about you, Paul?
Oh, I'd agree, and it seems like the more lakes you investigate, the more common these sightings are. You go up into Canada and you have Ogopogo and Igapogo,
right,
and Ponique and all sorts of lake monsters. So it seems to be a common global phenomena.
And why couldn't? Jeff, who was, help me, the scientist we had on a couple of years ago who had all the soundings
in
Lake Champlain?
Elizabeth von Muggenthaler.
There you go. Thank you. Who had these incredible recordings of something in Lake Champlain. And, of course, there are a number of sightings there. Champ. Champ has been seen. What was seen by the discoverer, quote-unquote, the European discoverer of Lake Champlain, who the explorer Champlain, who saw the creature himself. So there's definitely something in these lakes. And Nessie, of course, becomes the prototype of this type of lake monster, kind of reptilian, hearkening back to a dinosaur of some sort.
In the picture that was taken by Sandra Manzi in Lake Champlain is just a classic head and neck, turned, twisted, and you know, it's hard to gauge exactly how large it is other than by eyewitness testimony because of the references in the lake, because they're not exactly sure where the picture was taken, but I consider that a legitimate photo, and I think most people who've analyzed it accept it. It's a matter of, you know, what it is.
Now, what about the controversy over the doctor's photograph of Nessie?
Oh, right. Well, I'm not really sure. I know it was taken on, or released rather, on April Fool's Day, in the R.K. Wilson photo. I'm not sure where that stands. You got the same type of controversy with the Patterson film.
Exactly.
For Bigfoot.
Same type.
I'm sorry?
I was going to say maybe you should explain for some people what the Patterson-Glimlum photograph is.
Oh, right. The Patterson film being the famous 1967 film that was taken out in Bluff Creek, California, of an alleged Bigfoot creature. And it just becomes a huge he said argument.
Right.
And it goes back and forth for years. And sometimes some of the explanations are even more interesting than the story itself.
And more preposterous.
Absolutely. This may have dealt with a feud with a newspaper back in England, or Scotland, rather. So,
right.
With the Patterson film, I can remember when they were accusing John Chambers of hoaxing it.
Yeah.
I mean, it just becomes preposterous at some time.
It does. Now, our next one, and this didn't surprise me because of the enormous, shall we say, popularity of the chupacabra, the goat sucker. This, again, is thought of as a recent phenomenon, but it's really not, is it, Paul?
No, there's a bit of a history here. Now it's become part of pop culture again, just like the Jersey Devil.
Yeah, wow, yeah. T-shirts, probably children's lunch boxes, you name it.
well,
could be. Who knows?
In
Mexico, they do funny things. Okay, back in a couple minutes as we continue. Don't go away. Okay, Brad, name that tune.
I need more.
What?
Oh. I need more.
I thought that was the name of the tune.
That would be a good movie.
I want more.
I want more.
All right, this has to do with street. This is too easy.
Oh, well, then it's got Ring a nightmare time. On.
Oh, geez, I didn't finish the clue. That's it.
That's where Freddy would come out, see the teenagers, say,
"Hello, my precious."
He'd say, "I want more.
I want more."
All right, let's get back to our guest and our list. I've got some wonderful feedback in my ear. The music sounds loud and clear, but it's gone now. Now it's gone. I was hearing myself in my own ear, and there's anything I can't stand to hear, it's me. Huh. All right. Back to business.
Chupacabra.
Yeah. All right, we got a list we got to zip through here, so let's move it right on.
Right. How much credence do you put in chupacabra actually being a physical entity, Paul?
I'm not sure. It seems to go back to about the 1990s. A few cases possibly from before, but that seemed to be where it got its
real medium. I agree. Late 90s.
Yeah, that's where it picked up steam.
Yeah.
But
Puerto Rico, then to Mexico,
right.
South Florida, even to Texas, even in Southern California.
Yeah, and it's kind of similar to some of the cattle mutilation things because they incorporate it with kills on pets. And
sure
on,
had a lot of dead animals, yeah.
Right,
so obviously there's some sort of physical evidence and some sort of physical phenomena going on, but the creature itself, it does smack of being something paranormal.
Yes. It you cannot deny that it looks and sounds very demonic in nature.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Okay, the next one, werewolves, such as the Monster of Bray Road. There have been so many werewolf type or shape shifter being reported lately. Linda Godfrey, of course, has been doing a marvelous job collecting those. So this was number 5, werewolves such as the Monster of Bray Road.
I have a question. Every one of these things, every one of these illustrations, these guys look like they've been pumping iron at Gold's Gym for 20 years.
Yeah.
Look at them.
Yeah.
They're ripped.
Yeah.
Well,
then that indicates their preternatural power, both physically and... I remember Linda saying, and other people have said, with the werewolf or the shapeshifter or whatever these are, when they make eye contact, you know, there's that strange feeling, not only of fear, but as if there is an intelligence that, you know, almost hypnotic and luring them. So they're powerful spiritual beings as well as physical beings.
And we sure do have a lot of eyewitnesses, I'll tell you. And it only takes one of them to be correct, and then we got certainty.
Now, another of my favorites, number six, the flying serpents or the Thunderbird.
Yeah.
What about that one, Paul?
Well, I think those are some very credible reports. I can remember a pilot report. You know, I can't remember exactly where it was, whether it was Alaska. Or where it was, but
yeah.
He actually saw it and said it was about the size of a Cessna, one of these birds flying in the air.
Big bird.
And so that's very credible. And the idea, I know Mark Hall has done extensive work with Lauren Coleman on this. And I think they make a pretty interesting case for some of these giant birds existing.
All right.
Now, people make them into raptors or flying pterosaurs and so forth. Could be, or they could just be extraordinary large birds. I mean, there were several reports I remember a number of years ago from Illinois, all around, I think, the Alton, Illinois area. And again, people were describing them the size of small single-planed aircraft. Just
we've all seen the picture, Brad, of the eight or ten guys holding up this giant bird with, you know, turn of the century.
Yeah.
But I think the photo's been discredited, hasn't it?
Yeah. I keep hearing music. Is that just me? Or
no, that's must be a gift from GCN.
It's a gift.
All kinds of fun things going on.
There was a famous film taken back in the 70s.
That was me.
Of one of these creatures. That's a case where you can compare the size of the creature that was being filmed to, you know, to the surrounding trees and so forth.
Mm-hmm. The one from the Civil War, that's a classic. And then there's the one of the bunkhouse where the cowboys are holding it.
Yeah,
have you seen those?
Yeah. Remember the one in the Beverly Hillbillies?
No, I don't remember that one.
Oh.
Did the Beverly Hillbillies go after it?
Maybe I've got it wrong. I don't know.
Yeah. Number seven is Spring-Heeled Jack.
There's a favorite crowd pleaser everywhere.
After all these years, Spring-Heeled Jack that terrorized London, leaping over fences. Was he an extraterrestrial? Was he a demon? Was he from outer space and time? What do you think, Paul?
Well, boy, the report was very strange. You know, that's just a classic from the 1830s. And red-eyed, again, which seems to keep popping up, wearing a blue helmet, having the springs on the heels of its boots, and attacking women mostly.
Right.
Very strange.
All these spacemen are always after Earth women.
Well, you know, John Keel, there were other sightings of similar type creatures in New Mexico and Massachusetts. There was a spate of sightings in Ohio that Keel investigated from the early 60s, in which he tied a similar type of creature to cattle mutilation.
Right, very good. Stand by. We'll take a break and come right back, finish our list, and carry on. That's what the mice hear when they run around all night. It's true. It's mouse vertigo.
That's I think that's very aptly titled.
Thank you. Just don't get any sleep the night before. You can do this every night yourself if you want to. All right, ladies and gentlemen, back to the list. We're up. We've passed Spring-Heeled Jack. Living dinosaurs, always interesting, fascinating. And why not? What was the movie long time ago where they...
Well, the one we talked about with Ray is Valley of the Guanji.
That's
exactly
right.
That. You know,
right.
Cowboys lassoing the a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Well, that's a
wreck.
Trip, as they say.
And now we have so many of them in Africa. So this is Mowgli, Mbembe. You know, I have to give that a strong, real possibility. Don't you, Paul?
Oh, absolutely. And I can remember back a few years ago when Roy Mackle was leading expeditions into the Congo.
Right.
Try to get footage of that creature, and they came back with a lot of eyewitness testimony. And, you know, I think it's probably a matter of time before we actually have some footage of something like that.
Yeah, and there's no reason, you know, especially in the oceans. That's why I've always...
Come on, yeah, it's where three-fourths of the world's surface is ocean.
What could
ocean?
Be down there, you know? Again, the
yeah.
Very close to the top 10 where the Kraken, the huge right. octopus, that nearly made the list.
Very good. Right.
Now, the Flatwoods Monsters, not a monster. Now we're getting into the UFO. Paul, what's your take on the Flatwoods Monster?
Oh, that is just one of the classic UFO tales, and you go back to September of 1952 when nine witnesses saw this big ball of fire, some said as big as a house, and they said that this creature seemed to come from it. It was described as being the size of an enormous man down to the waist, but no arms. And it had a distinct head shape. And all the witnesses said this. I know Ivan Sanderson went down and investigated many of the witnesses there, interviewed them. He said the head was shaped like the Ace of Spades and with large circular window, which looked to have beams inside, a couple of beams, which would, of course, be eyes. This is just a classic case where... there was no question about the witnesses. Everybody was sure that they were sincere, that this legitimately scared them. One had fainted.
Right.
Some needed medical attention from fleeing. But this thing seemed to move in a circular motion and just scared the heck out of everybody.
Yeah.
There were a couple of sightings before that and a couple after that were unrelated to the initial sighting. But, this is one of the strange...
Yeah, I'm really surprised in one sense that this has captured the imagination. Now, the Hopkinsville Little Green Men, that also almost made the list.
Mm-hmm.
That would be
my favorite, actually. It sounds like a movie in the making. You have a secluded farmhouse and out in the country, and you got a family around, and all of a sudden, they seem to be besieged by these beings that are floating. And so they grab their shotguns. Shots are exchanged. The creatures seem to absorb the bullets and then come right back. Just a really strange ufology case and investigated by Blue Book.
Yeah, and as I said, that came very close to making the top 10. Now, the number 10, the Dover Demon. I don't know what category to put that in.
Gold's Gym. Gold's Gym. Yeah, look at the arms. Come on.
No, right. I don't know about the Dover. Oh, excuse me. What we have below there, Jeff, is for Dr. Melton. That's a Nosferatu type of vampire.
Oh, I thought it was the Dover.
No, I'm sorry there. We should have. But the Dover Demon, tell us about that, Paul.
Right. This was a case from April of 77 in which this 4-foot-tall being was seen by a teenager driving a truck down the road, and he saw this along a sort of a rocky fencing area. And this being, which had long arms and long digits and this large head with orange eyes, but no mouth, no ears, no tail visible, was walking along this rock wall, and the eyes were described as being the size of like two large orange marbles. So this was seen by four teenagers. I can remember the the law enforcement official, I think it was a police chief, had said that the witnesses were all very credible. Everything was very sincere here. There was no signs of a hoax. And I remember Lauren had investigated this quite extensively. In fact, I went down to the Fort Fest down in Washington back in 78, and this was one of the cases he had lectured on.
It's a strange case. I mean, it's a creature kind of like no other. It's about four mm-hmm. feet tall, and like you say, hairless body, long, spindly limbs, mm-hmm. and a big watermelon-shaped head, and nearly as big as the body. If it had more than two limbs or four limbs, it almost sounds like a big spider, giant insect walking.
Yeah, a very, very strange case. And again, harps of paranormal. And, you know, there's a couple of Hollywood movies in this somewhere.
Yeah. Well, I think here again, and you know me, I see the paranormal on a lot of these. You know, I think there's a physicality. I sometimes say the paraphysicality. I think all of these things are real for a time, and then they go back into what other dimension from which they came. But then there are others, you know, that I like, the lake monsters, like Bigfoot and so forth, where I think there can indeed be a physical reality as well. I mean, a permanent physical reality, or I don't know, maybe it's all part of the fascinating world of monsters. Maybe we need monsters, but then maybe they need us. No, they need us as much as we need them. We have to see them. We have to grant them reality.
Absolutely. From a social anthropological point of view, why are these creatures seen and all over the world?
Yes.
It's a common human experience, so I would agree completely about there's some sort of paranormal aspect, if it's nothing more than its own elusivity.
I agree, and I thank you so much, Paul, for sharing your expertise and coming through and kind of the 11th hour here and helping out with this.
Well, I enjoyed it very much. Pleasure to talk with you both.
Thank you, Paul.
Happy Halloween.
Indeed.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Good night. Okay, we'll pause and come right back. Lots more ahead in just a couple minutes. Sound. That's what you hear when you go out at night to the barn without a flashlight.
Well, that's good.
Is that all right?
That's a good description.
Thank you. See,
you're really hitting on all eight tonight.
No. 3 hours sleep last night. That'll do it every time.
Sometimes
okay.
It does, you know?
Well,
sometimes
yep.
It does.
Yep. All right, now, we have another special guest. Is he with us now?
I'm here.
See?
There he is.
As if by magic. What a beautiful voice, too. A man could have been a narrator of travelogues.
Well, he's just come back from a European tour. I think he's been collecting vampire steaks over there. I'm eager to hear what Gordon
I mean, seriously. Gordon, you could have done Wally Byam, Airstream, caravans to Transylvania. I mean, you could have narrated those.
I could have, yes.
Well, there's still time. You could do your own. And
anyway, welcome back to the States, Gordon.
Oh, thank you, Brett.
I guess you're not on the no-fly list, I assume.
No, I seem to be getting through okay.
Yeah.
Good.
How was
that? We have desperate need of our annual vampire report. So what do you have for us to start off with? A startling headline to start us off.
All right. Well, what I've discovered is that since the beginning of this century, there have been over 900 vampire novels written and published.
Gee.
900. As books. This doesn't count the e-books and the children's books and
comic books
and other things, but just straight out novels.
That's amazing.
And that's more than had been published throughout history up to that point.
Who wrote the first great one?
The first great one, William Polidori.
Okay.
Way back in 1819.
Mm-hmm. Now, we should mention, we didn't really introduce Dr. Melton properly.
He snuck in on us.
It's
been reading too many of those vampire books.
It probably flew in the window and just sort of materialized.
That's right.
But he is the author, for our purposes now, of the monumental vampire encyclopedia, the vampire book, and he is known in his other life as an authority on American religion and theological movements and spiritual movements in the United States. So you wear two interesting mantles, that of a scholar of theological religious movements, and then a scholar of the vampire. You managed to balance them very well.
It does make some interesting convergences.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Among people I work with.
Yes, I have. You know, every once in a while I'll be surfing, and I'll find someone who does not share my enthusiasm for your vampire research and feel that, you know, you should be sticking to business as God intended.
Yes. It does happen that way.
We talked last time about, I guess we could call it contemporary vampirism, but it's more vamp than ism in terms of the actual full vampire dose of treatment. But there are a lot of people who are into bleeding and piercing and cutting and all kinds of weird bloodletting. It's a pretty bizarre, and I guess there are almost clubs and groups where these people get together and meet each other, but it's a bizarre thing. And it's apparently become kind of trendy with some of our younger people.
It has, and it's become more and more organized and more institutionalized, so to speak.
How so?
Well, in the big cities now, there are places that one can go and meet other people who are into blood drinking, and the Internet has actually spurred this on. I don't know if you remember a couple of years ago when there was this spat of things floating around the email announcing get-together days.
Right,
meet-up days.
Right.
Well, in all of that, someone had posed these vampire meet days. Everybody who's a vampire come and meet. And those seem to have become actually something that happened in different cities, and now there are little groups of people in most of the major cities in the West.
How little are the groups?
They are fairly small. Most of them no more than 10, 20 people. In some of the larger cities, L.A., Toronto, New York, they're much larger, maybe as many as 100 or 200, though that group rarely ever gets together as a total group.
Right. And yet that little tiny group and smattering of people seem to make a little bit of noise on the Internet and elsewhere.
Well, they're unusual enough and that they attract a lot of attention and
As a society, we like freaks and freakisms and freakish behavior. And, oh, come on, this is a sideshow thing and it's melodrama and there's a little sadism mixed in that ugly soup as well.
And it allows most of us to have a little bit of feeling of superiority as well.
Well, we have a local lad who has actually obviously gone to the dentist and had fangs put in. He drives a hearse. We see the hearse driving around. And Sherry and I keep thinking, one of these days, he's going to want to marry, settle down, have kids, and then he's going to look at all those fangs in his mouth and saying, oh, back to the dentist. I mean, there has to, I think, for many, many of these young people, come that moment of realization that, well, maybe I can pretend through movies or books. I don't have to really dress up like this.
Wait just a minute. I don't have any trouble speaking with them. You can't.
Yeah.
You don't hear them.
But,
my lip getting caught.
You've had them so long, though.
Well, I guess. All right.
No, I actually met someone a couple of months ago like that. When I had first met him, he had put fangs in. This has been, this is 10, 15 years ago. He was actually a blood drinker, had buried a woman who was his major donor. And
he buried a woman? Who was his major donor? Oh.
Yes.
Thought maybe he took too much out of her bank.
And was putting out vampire music and this kind of thing. I met him this summer. He came up and introduced himself to me. I didn't recognize him.
Just recognize him without his fangs.
The fangs were gone. The hairdo was gone. The whole look had changed.
And pretty boring, huh?
I assume that he's gone on with his musical career, as he was a very fine, classically trained musician.
You know, Gordon, I bet you had the same experience that I have. You know, in the '60s, going around visiting so many hippie communes. Seeing the people, their long hair and the mode of dress that was popular at the time, and then meeting them years later in three-piece suits and so forth, with the hair trimmed and so forth. I'm sure you've had that same experience.
I've had that experience as well as meeting some of the unreconstructed ones. As well.
Yeah, there are some of those. Now, again, we cannot for one moment put this in an area of teenage rebellion and leave it there, can we? I mean,
no.
This does become a way of life for many people.
It does, and it hangs on for many of them for a very long time. There's some point at which the rationale for drinking blood and living this kind of life sort of peters out.
Mm-hmm.
That, in fact, old age creeps up on all of us.
Yeah. Oh, there you go again. Now, just a minute. And for some people, it doesn't get boring. I'm trying to do some Halloween stuff here.
Yeah, some Halloween.
I don't want people to believe me.
You know how
people are.
Did you encounter the goth or vampire movement in Germany, Gordon?
I only saw it very, very slightly. I haven't spent a lot of time in Germany. When I was there 2 years ago, I met some goths who were hanging around the Dracula Museum that I visited in Frankfurt.
Was that a mobile or a permanent museum?
Very permanent.
Really?
And it's a very fine museum, as a matter of fact. They've done a very good job of putting it together and have a couple of the German vampire scholars helping them. And
wax figure of Bela and all that?
No, they've got some stuff from some of the German vampire movies, and they have the kind of collection of odd mementos, very European-oriented, Christopher Lee autographs and those kinds of things. But overall, it's a very, very well-done job.
Now, the motion pictures, the recent movies, of vampires. Have you seen any of the recent ones, Gordon?
I've seen most of them except a couple of the. I haven't seen Ultraviolet yet, and there's a couple of them I haven't seen. The Underworld movies I like very much, and gave kind of mixed reviews to Van Helsing. As you may be aware, the new television series of Blade
right.
Has been canceled and
right.
will no longer be with us.
What was that about?
This was trying to bring the Blade character from Marvel comic books to the screen.
Have you seen any of the movies, Jeff, the Blade movies?
I've seen all three of them, and the first one was very good.
Yeah, yes, are these vampire movies?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh,
so Blade's a vampire hunter.
But that's a good one, huh?
Very good.
First one, Wesley Snipes, Kris Kristofferson as his guide. The first one was very good. The second one, it seems like it's very difficult. I mean, we're just talking about the Nightmare at Elm Street movies, you know, the Freddy movies. It just seems very difficult to make sequels. It just becomes a cottage industry.
Yeah, it's sequels, and when I see sequel, I kind of stay away. But yeah.
Yeah, the Blade movies kind of got into a can you top this mode, and after he killed Dracula in the third one, it was very hard to
top. Yeah.
Top that.
All right, hold on, gang. We have to pause. We'll be right back in just a few minutes.